Welcome everyone to the final session of the 2022-23 Football Scholars Forum season. We're very excited to have this roundtable discussion today on the 2023 Women's World Cup, which takes place July 20th to August 20th in Australia and New Zealand, Aotearoa. A tournament of firsts, as you all probably know. It's the first co-hosted Women's World Cup by Australia and New Zealand, Aotearoa. First in the Southern Hemisphere, first with 32 teams, and the first, as far as I know, with guaranteed prize money of about $30,000 US for all players. So we'll begin with the introductory remarks by our terrific scholars that have kindly agreed to sort of frame the discussion, Jean Williams, Brenda Elsie, and Hilary Haldane. They will collectively raise several of the major issues, social, cultural, political, economic, sporting, media related to the tournament, and then probably offer some insights that are connected to their research. And then we'll open up the field for discussion. So please use the raise hand function in Zoom if you'd like to ask a question. And you can use the chat function to share resources, add comments, links. And as always, it's a great place for some friendly banter. This is, after all, a kind of intellectual knockabout or pelada. So I will post the recording to the website after the final whistle. So let me briefly introduce the speakers in the order in which they will proceed. Jean Williams, historian, curator, author of numerous books. Everybody knows Jean. I'm not going to give a full CV here, but author of A Game for Rough Girls, A History of Women's Football in England, A Beautiful Game, International Perspectives on Women's Football, A Contemporary History of Women's Sport, 1850 to 1960, and has a new book on the England women's national team coming out shortly, and also a kind of crossover book in 2022 entitled The History of Women's Football. She's been a historical consultant for the National Football Museum in England and engages in many, many, many public history and heritage projects, many of them linked to women's football. Brenda Elsie, historian of popular culture, especially football and politics in 20th century Latin America, also a scholar of gender and social theory and Pan-Americanism, the author of Citizens and Sportsmen, Football and Politics in 20th Century Chile, and with Joshua Nadel of Futbolera, Women, Gender, and Sexuality in Latin American Sport, both those books from University of Texas Press, also the co-editor of Football and the Boundaries of History. She is the co-founder and co-host of the sports feminist podcast, Burn It All Down. Last but not least, Hilary Haldane, whose research sits at the intersection of indigeneity, gender-based violence, and culture, anthropologist with regional expertise in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and Australia, and has published on football, FIFA's Feminist Foot Soldiers, Looking for Equality in the Women's Game, Approaching the 2023 World Cup in Australia and Aotearoa, in an edited volume on the 2019 FIFA Women's World Cup, and then a forthcoming chapter entitled The Marketing and Branding of Indigeneity in the FIFA Women's World Cup 2023, Marketing Maori, in a forthcoming FIFA World Cup Politics, Representation, and Management edited volume. So it's a great pleasure to have our eminent scholars with us and you all. And let me turn it over then to Jean, who will present some introductory remarks. Over to you, Jean.
Thank you, Peter. And thank you for the invitation to speak today. And it's a real pleasure and an honor to be on a panel with Brenda and Hilary, whose work I greatly admire. So thank you for the invitation. 7 points, really, I want to raise because I was asked to speak for about 7 minutes. So one of the things that struck me, and some of the people on this call will have sat with me in the stands in the 2019 Women's World Cup in France. And wow, how things have changed even since 2019, since that first appalling opening match when we couldn't get into the stands. And a number of us were frustrated by the ticketing strategies. Things have changed really radically in that time, not least by the rush to women's football. So historians commonly use the term the rush to rugby, to talk about what happened in the British public schools. But certainly in the UK, what has happened since the women won the Euros last year, and in the wider context of the hosting of that tournament, is that there's been a rush to women's football. You literally cannot see an advertisement for cereal, for insurance, for financial goods, for more or less anything without a girl footballer appearing on it. And obviously, the normalisation of those images of young women playing football are hugely encouraging on the one hand, but we also have to look at whether the rush to women's football is cosmetic, in terms of a lot of people are now saying that the Women's Super League is the greatest women's league in the world, which I would contest. I think it's part of the sports washing of what's going on in a lot of British football at the moment. And would we have things like the Barclays Women's Super League sponsored by a bank unless we'd had the financial crash of 2008, when a lot of those financial institutions were discredited and are subsequently trying to rehabilitate their reputations through associating themselves with women's football to look progressive? So there's the rush to women's football, but how long-lived and how deep is that rush to women's football is the first thing that I'll just throw out there. The second one that concerns me more is that a number of us will know through the conferences that we've gone to for a number of years is that women have pioneered the study of women's football as an academic topic. And yet within the UK, there is a growing liberal feminist hegemony of progress being made in the women's game. So, you know, when FIFA triple prize money is seen as massive examples of progress, I would come at it from a more radical perspective. I don't think women's football is making progress because I think that problematizes women. I think what we're seeing is a process of continuity and change. And I would argue that actually, rather than tripling the prize money with the reserves that FIFA have, they could easily have made this the first equal pay Women's World Cup, because with the amount of money that they have in reserves, let alone in active cash, then that prize money is arbitrary. And the arbitrariness of that amount, I think, constitutes a trivialization of women's football. The third point off the back of that is Gianni as a defender of women's football. You know, FIFA are setting themselves up now as the defender of women's football, and those mean media outlets won't pay what women's sport is worth. I know we've survived a Trump presidency, barely, and a Boris Johnson prime ministership, even a Liz Truss prime ministership. But goodness me, Gianni and FIFA as defenders of women's football, which is how they're now portraying themselves in the approach to this Women's World Cup. And, you know, the prize money argument is not the same as equal pay. And it is arbitrary. It's an amount that a man who is reputedly paid £2 million a month in salary and doesn't like to pay for his own dry cleaning has kind of plucked out of the air and said, that's how much we'll give them this time. The fifth point is an expanded tournament, which again is hugely encouraging. But I think what a lot of us saw in 2019 with the likes of the Reggae Girls in terms of Jamaica, and in some of the other nations, is that unless an individual woman entrepreneur is willing to back those national teams, the national associations are still underfunding those women. And I would argue that this World Cup is one of the most bitterly contested in terms of gender relations that we have ever had. Never mind all those African nations, and you'll know I spent quite a bit of time in Namibia. And the Namibian women were not even funded by their national association to play qualifiers, let alone ever get to a World Cup. So who's excluded from that 32-team expansion? But let's talk about Spain and, you know, the players who are not going to make it this time around because of Jorge Vilda and his technical support for many years across that the technical directorate in Spain. We have that situation. We have the situation in Canada. We have the situation in Mexico, not to mention the situation in Afghanistan. So again, I keep coming back to this liberal feminist hegemony, which is something I'm going to be talking about at all the conferences that I'm doing this summer, because we have to get away from this idea of, you know, rah, 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 women's sport. And there's a recent Netflix documentary that's been made about the unstoppable rise of women's sport. Well, I think that liberal feminist thesis is easily bulldozed. And then my final comment is, I cannot believe we're going to have a Women's World Cup without Grant Wall. He was with us in 2019. Many of us shared a meal with him in Paris. And he just seemed to be, you know, one of the great fixtures of Women's World Cups. And certainly I'll be thinking a lot about him during this tournament and paying tribute to the enormous contribution he made. And I know that Women's World Cup was very important to Grant personally. So just wanted to close on those comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Jean. And thank you for remembering our good friend Grant, whose passing has just been one of the saddest things to really affect football and football studies, for sure. Lost a giant. Over to you, Brenda.
Well, that's really a hard act to follow. Jean hits all the good notes, as always, and I'm honored to be on a panel with her and also to like open up this conversation with all of you, because I see so many people here that have done so much amazing work on this subject. So thanks for having me, and I really appreciate it. So let's see, what are some of the things that Jean didn't say or that I can dialogue with, because I have so many of the same feelings. And I'm sorry, because doing this kind of work is being a constant feminist killjoy. There's just no way around it. I embrace it. This is what it is. So here we go. You know, I think I am writing a piece right now on the Colombian team and the Colombian Women's Federation. And this is where I could probably use a little grant to dialogue with and bring that sunshine and optimism. So I'll just say, in doing it, I've thought a lot about how loving women's soccer just is. It just is accepting that you're going to be perpetually ambivalent, punctuated by moments of joy and horror, and that's what it is. And so I'm going to take it from a Latin American perspective a little bit, because the others are much better on the rest of the world. But we've seen like a pretty steady decline in some of the important Latin American women's programs, including Brazil and Mexico. I understand Brazil is still ranked by FIFA as number 8. I'm not sure they belong there. And if they are, it's despite instead of because of their federations. When we look at kind of what is frustrating as a fan, or why these women are experiencing some of the things that Jean pointed out, you know, in terms of the negligence, I think we have to look again and again at the structure and the governance of men's and women's football together. So broadcasting rights is a great way to start. You know, the people who are negotiating those types of things and the corruption that we're seeing, the fact that given that in 2019, it was the first huge case of the Colombian women's national team where players went to criminal court to accuse the Federation of sexual abuse of minors, that has been followed up by four similar cases in Colombia, and that it's the same people that are on FIFA council. They have had absolutely no repercussions. That even when FIFA tries to do the right thing, and I'm just including teams that are going to be in this World Cup, like Haiti, right? Where FIFA says, okay, we're going to ban, you know, Jean-Yves Barre, the, you know, for whatever, for lifetime, and then CAS overturns it. It's like, it's this sort of frustrating labyrinth that doesn't work on purpose, that is designed like this intentionally and allowed to go on. So I think one of the tough things about getting these messages, or like, okay, if we hate this, let's just not go on and on, but how do you be constructive about it? It's that it's hard for people to grasp the magnitude and the ways in which these structures work, right? Like, the devils are in the details. The details are boring. You don't want to take away from women's wonderful athletic accomplishments and abilities and how much you love this sport. But when you see Colombia at this World Cup, you will not see some of their best players. You will not see them. They will not be called up. I have Pete here. He can speak probably even more eloquently, potentially, you know, other people. But you will not see, and haven't seen for many years, people like Yareli Rincon. You will not see Natalia Gaitán, because if they haven't been vetoed by the coach because of speaking out about the conditions, then they have been, like in the case of, Isabella Echeverri, they've been pushed into retirement at the age of 27. So who's there, who's not there, is like constantly part of what's on my mind. I'm waiting to see that final list of Argentina to get really, really, really mad. not there yet. But those are the types of things that are happening. And as Jean said, the narrative is so hard to fight against the liberal feminist hegemony. And I think it's a perfect way to think through it. And it's hard to get kind of a different voice there and in there about, like, what do you want progress in women's football to mean? Why is it okay to wait 3 more cycles for equitable pay? Is it because you should accept sexism for 6 years? Because eventually it's okay. Why is it okay for 1 year or any amount of time, right? So anyway, these are the types of things that maybe we can think through together. But I think there's just this kind of feeling like if you put the brakes on any of this celebration, that it must just be, you sort of stymieing these wonderful athletes. And that's the pressure that I think we all have when we're coming in with some real critical thoughts, right? And then just finally, I guess I would say trans issues have not been discussed at all, as well as intersex and sex verification testing. We know that many federations are taking it into their own hands right now to go way beyond what FIFA and the IOC have even attempted to do in terms of gender verification testing, randomly, voluntarily, without cause. It happened to Barbara Banda, who failed her verification testing and could not compete, the Zambia captain. I'm really worried about what's going on with a lack of transparency from these people across the board. And we know it happens in men's football, but I think, you know, we also need to look at it, look at the ecosystem of it together, right? The fact that these national federations are permitted to operate in these ways, like, for example, and I'll just end on this. You know, accountability, corruption for me is the center for feminism right now in football. The idea that, okay, great, you're going to pay the players directly. Are you? Or is it going to the federation? Because if it's going to the federation, they're never getting it. They'll get a fraction of it. And then there'll be a lot of overhead fees, lots of fees. We had to process your whatever. So it's very important. And I haven't read that. I haven't seen that. So that's a very nice announcement to make. But I want to see that they've asked the women for their direct deposit details. And until then, you know, I think we have to stay really vigilant about some of this while I understand also enjoying and celebrating. So I'll end on my typically not fun note, but it's only because I care an awful lot.
Great points. Yeah, we need the receipts. Over to, thank you, Brenda. Over to Hillary.
Yeah, thanks to Jean and Brenda, really, for setting up the, you know, the kind of political economy that we need to be discussing in relation to this tournament. I'm going to just offer some information more specifically about the host countries. For me, this tournament is really this, you know, marriage of kind of all my research interests, so gender-based violence and structural violence and settler colonial violence, indigeneity, and this particular region of the world. And so for me, it's, to Brenda's point, it's made it incredibly impossible for me to just enjoy the tournament because it is so layered with gender-based violence, structural violence, historical violence. And I think we have to discuss the important point about settler colonial violence in the context of these two host nations, as well as the host nation from 2015 and the forthcoming host nations for 2026. The interest for me is that I think we need to consider, I want to use the tournament from 2022 in Qatar for us to kind of think about the way that particularly European, white-dominated European and white-dominated USian media framed that tournament. And so leading up to the tournament, there was a righteous outrage, as there should be, about the treatment of all the migrant workers. I think that I don't want to make this a false equivalence about, you know, things are bad in Qatar, but things are also bad in Australia. That's not what I want to do here. But I do think that there was justifiable and righteous outrage around many of the harms that are ongoing in Qatar around migration. What I would say, though, is one of the things I've started looking at is the framing of the media was so incredibly orientalist and Islamophobic and just Eurocentric in terms of talking about people's lives and especially women, you know, so the issue about kind of women coming up in Qatar. And I think that, you know, looking at that in terms of how we view the problems in Qatar, the word, you know, traditional culture kept being used. And I find that as an anthropologist, I find that really interesting because I'm like, what do you mean by tradition? You know, I think from a political economic standpoint, they're as embedded in the global economy as the two host countries we have in front of us. So just the framing, how people frame things of Qatar, I think is really interesting that we've seen so little in that same media about, and again, not to make a false equivalence, but about the ongoing real human rights violations that happen in both Aotearoa and in Australia. So the host nations themselves have their own set of problems. And so how do we maybe approach it culturally relative, but looking at some of the issues, the fact that Australia still has offshore detention sites where refugees are living in incredibly harmful situations. They have prevented, the government of Australia has prevented the UN from entering into their prisons to do investigations. Both host countries were two of the four countries in 2007 that refused to sign on to the United Nations declarations on the rights of indigenous peoples. You can guess who the other two countries were. They are hosting the 2026. They're two of the three hosts for the 2026 upcoming FIFA tournament. Now, while all four Kansas countries have reversed course on the declaration, I think thinking through a settler society lens is really important in looking at how the kind of political context for these two countries in. And I also don't want to make a false equivalence between Australia and Aotearoa. That's, you have to treat, I feel like we need to treat each country in its own ways. But I'll say something I would really like everyone who's an outsider who's going to be visiting for the tournament or viewing the tournament to be paying attention to is there's a really important referendum that is going on in Australia that will be voted on. The date has yet to be set by Parliament, but it'll be voted on between October and December of this year. And it's a referendum that would give a voice to First Nations people in Parliament. Of the four kind of Kansas settler societies that we talk about, Canada, the United States, Australia, and Aotearoa, New Zealand, Australia is the only one with no treaty. There is no treaty for First Nations people and the Crown. And so this referendum is critical in terms of being the first step, the argument of the people who have framed the referendum, in being a voice to Parliament, which they would hope would eventually lead to a treaty. Now, there are Aboriginal and First Nations and Torres Strait Islander scholars and activists who are absolutely opposed to the voice. But more, I think seriously, is there are many settler, white settler Australians who are actively opposed to the voice. The people who are supporting the voice would say, yes, we understand that for the First Nations people who are opposed to this, the issue is they would rather have a treaty, that this voice is just kind of this liberal, you know, kind of band-aid on the issue. But they would say, if we don't ever get this voice, then we're never going to get a treaty. And I think more people are becoming sympathetic to that viewpoint. But there is real grave concern that this won't pass. And I just want to give a little bit of historical context for this. In 1967, the last time there was a major referendum in Australia related to the lives and well-being of First Nations peoples, the referendum in 1967 essentially, in colloquial terms, gave First Nations people personhood. It was a referendum that would say, we will start counting First Nations peoples in the census. Before 1967, First Nations Indigenous peoples of Australia were not counted in the rolls, in a sense, not being considered human. And so the 1967 referendum was this massive change for the nation. It passed with over 90% of the support, which is massive. So why is it now that 50 some odd years later, we have another referendum that is aiming towards giving Indigenous peoples, First Nations people, a voice now in Parliament, and it's teetering? And so I just think that that's a context that for people, especially if you're going to be in Australia during the tournament, be paying attention to this. Likewise, in Aotearoa, there's going to be a general election. It'll be in October, of right after we leave, you know, from the tournament. And while protections for Indigenous and Native peoples of Aotearoa are much stronger, they've had a treaty in place since 1840, the Treaty of Waitangi, which essentially acts as the constitution for the nation. And Māori has been one of three official languages in the country since 1987. So you can, in Parliament, you can speak in sign language, you can speak in the colonial language of English, or you can speak in Te Reo Māori. Those are all official languages. There are debates over whether or not road signs should even be in both, in all languages, right? So should they be in Te Reo Māori as well as English? And so there is definitely a backlash, an anti-Indigenous, kind of an anti-Native settler backlash that's happening. And that is going to be a very consequential election as well. It'll upend if the right-wing party, which is the National Party, if they win, they will undo a lot of some of the very good things that happened under Jacinda Ardern's Labour Party, especially as they related to women, as they related to trans rights, as they related to Indigenous rights. So, for instance, under the Ardern Labour government in Aotearoa, the first Ministry of Sexual and Family Violence was established. The member of parliament who holds that ministry is Marama Davidson. She's a Napuhi woman. She's a member of the Green Party. I mean, that could go away. That's the kind of thing that when you switch governments like that, all that effort that has been going towards protecting the rights of trans, Indigenous, and, you know, and women, against sexual and family violence could go away. So I realize that that's not talking about football per se, but I just wanted to make sure people are aware that these are serious human rights and consequential issues, particularly as they relate to indigeneity as we're going into the tournament. And I'll say that, you know, Jean brought up the point that Gianni likes to think of himself as a defender, you know, FIFA, well, he personally, I think, but FIFA is the defender of women's football. I would say right now he's presenting himself as a defender of indigeneity. And the reason that I want to end on this point is, if you'll note that when the bids, as one bid was coming through, and Brenda, I really wanted Colombia, just so you know, but as one bid was going through, you'll notice that because of the fact that Māori is an official language in Aotearoa, all the stadia cities were listed in both languages. They were listed in the colonial language and they were listed in Te Reo Māori. All the Australian cities were listed in the colonial language. They were listed in English. And then even when the official announcements of the final stadia cities were chosen, that was in March of 2021, the Australian cities were all still in the colonial language only, and you had the Aotearoans in both. Hebrew and in English. And it wasn't until December of 2021 that you started to see the appearance of the First Nations languages for the Australian stadia. And you see, you know, when Gianni was doing some of his presentation of this, he's kind of wrapping himself in the symbols and the accoutrements of indigeneity. And I want to ask, well, we just unleashed the list of the 2026 cities for the Men's Cup coming up, being held in three countries that all have huge indigenous populations. And none of those stadia cities were listed with their native names. So was this just like a one-off embrace by Gianni of indigeneity? It's just a one and done. Or is there going to be any kind of effort in questioning why is it that the Canada, the United States and the Mexico tournament, where are the indigenous names for those cities? Because those all have peoples whose cultures are still there. So I just want to end on that note. I realize I didn't even touch on football, but that's just something I want everyone to be thinking about. Thanks.
Terrific. Thank you. And those are really important considerations. That's why having regional specialists adds so much to the conversation. So thank you. Who would like to ask the first question or pick up on one or perhaps more of the issues and questions raised by our panelists? Anyone? I was thinking of Samantha Kerr as a figure that could play into some of these issues related to identity and sporting nationalism versus indigeneity. Is Samantha Kerr someone to watch out for in terms of an athlete who might be kind of in danger of being manipulated, willingly or unwillingly, to play into the politics, for example, or surrounding the referendum, or, you know, the boosterism that often permeates hosting these events, you think?
Well, Sam's family's Indian. So she's Indian Australian. You know, so she's a brown Australian, but her family's Asian, Asian Indian in terms of where her identity rests. It's more if we see on the roster. I don't know when Australia is going to release their final roster. If Kaya Simon ends up on the roster or if Lydia Williams, they are two First Nations women. For right now, for the Ford Football Ferns squad, it's not clear if there's going to be any Maori women on the squad. You have a few Asian players on the Aotearoa squad, but you don't have any Maori right now. And so I do think that the issue is going to be, you know, the question for the legacy plans is, especially given that FIFA is dressing itself up in the symbols of indigeneity, will those legacy plans do anything to grow the game for Maori and First Nations children? And that's a really kind of critical question.
Excellent point. I mean, I see Samantha Kerr plastered on, you know, everything from FIFA 23 covers to, you know, almost every FIFA publication related to the tournament, not just because she's such a phenomenal footballer, but I think also because she does not fit those settler colonial, you know, body types and sort of physiognomy, perhaps, that we tend to often associate with Australia. Okay, anyone want to follow up any of those comments? Or maybe raise other points that you were interested in that you're going to be looking for in this tournament? Or do panelists want to respond to some of the issues the others raised? I know we're not all timid professors and journalists here.
I just wanted to respond to something that both Brenda and Jean brought up. Oh, sorry, I'll just go really quick. I'm taking students with me. So I taught a course this spring on the Women's World Cup, and then I'm taking students because that's always so much fun to travel with a bunch of undergrads. But the thing that I want to say that I think Jean and Brenda both hit on so importantly, it's not even just the the disparities between the women's game and the men's game. So what we did with the students is their assignments were to take all the teams that were going to be in the tournament and just looking at the disparities in those teams. And I think that the fact that you just that we're not, you know, the idea that there's actually money available. I mean, the billions of dollars that FIFA has available, and you're looking at the kind of funding for these teams who make it to the tournament. And it's, and I mean, I haven't heard yet of a bake sale for people to get their boots like we did at the last tournament, but it just worries me that we still, you know, if my students were just so shocked by those disparities, I'm like, how is that not bothering us going into this? And so I was just, you know, thankful that you brought that up, because I think talking about the political economy of this is at the core of it. That is itself the structural violence that so many of these players are dealing with.
Can I just quickly say too, you know, the FIFA Foundation, at least, I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, but at least until quite recently, the head of FIFA Foundation is none other than Mauricio Macri. And he is the neocon former president of Argentina, president of the country, then former president of Boca, who tried very hard to privatize Boca. So these are people with a long history, and you hear a lot people criticize his kind of neoliberal approach to civic associations and sports for development. But then as soon as he becomes elected of FIFA Foundation, billion dollar, whatever, he's gone. You can't find it. You don't find news about it. You don't find, I mean, it's amazing how they've worked it out. So it's very difficult for a student, for example, in your class, Hillary, to even find out this information, right? Like, and it's really complicated, but it's also like really plain to see the networks of people that we're talking about. And so a lot of times journalists might do a deep dive on kind of corruption of FIFA Foundation and of Mauricio Macri. The problem for me sometimes, all the time, is that it comes back to that is exactly the person that would be in charge of overseeing women's equity, right? And so until you connect those dots all the time and force it as like corruption is a feminist issue, I feel like corruption gets a lot of, you know, press, FIFA corrupt, corrupt, corrupt. But it's also like feminists need to, I think, to my mind, it needs to be their issue too. And often it's not connected. I don't know, just throwing that out there. So look at who would give you that money in FIFA. And when FIFA goes and puts something like FIFA forward and puts something where they say, oh, it's not just women development money, it's women and juveniles, right? Youth football and women football, right? That means it's going to boys. just keep in mind, that means it's going to, you know, academies like Flamengo, once again, who doesn't have a real academy for girls. So I think those details are hard to find on purpose and stuff.
Thank you for that. David and then Stefan.
Hi, thanks all. I tend to be very much opposed to co-hosting tournaments. I find the very concept of it flawed from the start, and has me especially cynical looking towards 2026. But I guess where there's danger could lie the salvation too. I think Aeschylus said that or something. I don't know, but this tournament seems to bother me less than others. And I don't know if that's just the remove that I personally have, having been to neither Australia nor New Zealand so far. Should we be a little bit more aware of the problems of the co-hosting here? What will this mean in terms of the carbon footprint of the tournament, the distance these players are going to be covering, the media covering as well, just in terms of getting from place to place. What will the weather conditions be like one location to the other in terms of their locations, and how might that factor into play? And also, any impact that you expect that this could have in terms of women's league football in Australia and or New Zealand, especially as there's been news the last couple of weeks that Australia is moving closer to an open system of promotion relegation for the men's side. Will we see investment from the men's teams in women's football? Will they be separate autonomous entities from the men's in their leagues? Could this World Cup have a major impact so that women's football in Australia and New Zealand can really, you know, what we've been seeing in terms of women's football in Europe in the past few years, are they going to be keeping pace, and can that tournament play, this tournament play a factor in that? Thanks.
I'm not sure how we want to proceed, given that any of the panelists could respond. And if we want to take the questions one by one, any preferences from Jean, Brenda, and Hillary? Or should we do a couple of questions and then come back to you?
Rachel might have a good answer to that too. A few other people might have some good answers to that.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, I haven't been keeping up on the domestic issue. I'm happy to talk about like the Mexican Women's League if we get around to that, but I would love to defer to someone else on what they think of as the professional ramifications for Australia.
I'm not sure on the ramifications for Australia, but one of the things that I would throw in there is that we have a movement at the moment in the UK where Kelly Simmons, who has been heading up the women's professional game and was the person behind appointing Hope Powell as the first ever national women's coach in 1998, has just stood down as head of the professional women's game. And she is keeping things pretty close to her chest. And there are talks of forming a, rather than the FA ostensibly owning the WSL, of forming a separate company of which the members of the WSL are active owners in that new company, and effectively moving it into the ownership of the Premier League. And that really concerns me, that women's football should become a sub-brand of the Premier League and the Championship, because if, as we've seen the increased influence of sports washing in the UK, you know, the recent Saudi involvement in Newcastle, the long-term involvement of the City Group at Manchester City, which again is often presented in the British press as a reinvigoration of that club rather than sports watching. It really concerns me that women's football is becoming less of an independent entity. And what I'd like to see more of is more female ownership of the likes of Angel City. I think there's some interesting crossovers. And a little bit like Brenda, you know, I'm almost a professional pessimist when it comes to women's football, with moments of joy. But it seems to me that there's a really interesting model developing at Angel City that could be used by other clubs and other countries. Is not just that women's football and football generally is part of the broader entertainment industry, and women obviously are just as badly treated within the entertainment industry as they are within the football industry. And I think having understood that, the fact that you've got the likes of Natalie Portman and those other women entrepreneurs, Serena Williams, who now have their own production companies. So they're trying to make female stories more readily available in the media, as well as backing women's sports. And it seems to me that that is the way to go, that you make a feminist enterprise female owned and run, rather than women's football being a sub-brand of men's football.
Yeah, I was just going to add for the two host countries, there's definitely, and one thing I want to say, someone put into the chat, which is spot on, that these are two countries, you know, small populations, but it seems like for every, you know, one citizen of the country, there's a sports scholar. So both Australia and Aotearoa are blessed with so many amazing locally and globally focused sports scholars, and they're hosting, I mean, I know Jean, you're participating in some events, and both countries are hosting a lot of discussions about this. And I would say that all of them are asking this question. So what is the legacy? What are these legacy plans going to do for the women's game? I mean, to grow the game in general. These are both countries for which soccer, football is not their top sport. And so there's the concern about how do we grow the sport itself? But particularly then for women. And I would say then particularly for Indigenous children to get into the game. With Aotearoa, something that's really interesting is that this is the third of three big sport World Cups that they've hosted. So in 2022, they had the Cricket World Cup, and then they had the Rugby World Cup for women. And now they're having the, you know, FIFA. So that itself, I think the combination of those three tournaments on top of each other, especially if anyone was paying attention to the women's recent Rugby World Cup, you know, the Black Ferns just took, you know, won the hearts of so many fans and supporters, that I think that the combination of the cricket, which the cricket and the rugby are the bigger sport, as well as netball in those countries, I think that compounding effect, people are cautiously optimistic that it's at least bringing attention to women and sports. But yeah, I think people are withholding much, you know, not investing too much yet in thinking that the legacy plans that both countries have developed are really going to result in this major transformation of bringing women anywhere close to equity, or even of their own kind. Like, let's not use that liberal feminist notion of equity, but what would it look like to truly have a transformative, you know, kind of progressive, you know, women's football program in either country?
Yeah, the history of FIFA legacy programs is not exactly encouraging. Stefan, and then John Dart has a question. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to read it from the chat, perhaps, John, or if you'd like to ask it yourself. But first, let's pass the ball over to Stefan, and over to you. Can you hear us, Stefan? Well, while we wait for the audio to come through, let me read John's question since it's in the chat. He asks, what is the panelist's view on the decision to reject Saudi Arabia's sponsorship of the tournament? Is it something to quote unquote celebrate?
I see. That's all it's... It's like, it's a good question. Like, I'm not laughing at your question at all, John. I don't know you, but that's a great question. It's also like an impossible question when, you know, like the Qataris own PSG. Like, I don't know where you start when Henry Kissinger is on the Human Rights and World Cup Committee for 2026 for the United States. Yes, he's still alive. And not only is he still alive, he's overseeing. Overseeing with his urchin presence the 2026 World Cup with Robert Kraft. And so it's like so hard, because on the one hand, Hillary talked about the Orientalism involved in the ways in which the media talked about Qatar. On the other hand, I was in Qatar doing observation for discrimination for the FAIR Network. And I can tell you, I've never seen anything in any environment in football as violently homophobic and misogynist as I experienced. And I study Argentina, so I'm just gonna leave that there. So yes, you have to be on guard for those kinds of, you know, facile critiques of places that we've looked at through an imperialist lens. At the same time, that's no reason to let them off the hook. There's Qatar had no business hosting that tournament for so many reasons. They were dragging Iranian women out of the stadium with the t-shirts. I was there. We tried everything we could to work with FIFA human rights committees and human rights managers and the FSSOs to stop it. It was absolutely impossible. I don't know who else was in Qatar. Anyone else in Qatar? Okay. So everything you saw was not nearly as bad as it was. And so my question is, you know, rejecting their sponsorship, you know, or rejecting Citibank's sponsorship, for it gets very dicey. On the one hand, I don't think you can just say, okay, because we do this one thing, then anything goes, right? But on the other hand, it's really tricky. I don't know. That's a very hard question when you're in a hyper-capitalized corporate environment that FIFA operates in, for me.
I do know John, and I know he will ask that question with a twinkle in his eye because he knows the answer. Look, what was that about? It was about the absolute contempt. I mean, who put that out without asking the local organising committees? So it was about the absolute contempt that FIFA has for the women's game. And there's a very old tactic in politics, which is, you know, you tell the public that things are going to be much worse than they are. And then when they're only half as bad, people are relieved because it's only half as bad as it was. So I definitely saw the announcement of the Saudi sponsorship, one, as part of the broader globalization of the Saudi influence through sport. And again, I've been tweeting about some of what's been happening in world golf, but only men's golf. And their interest in men's professional golf and not women's at all, which I think is another conversation to be had. So B, I think the idea was floated to say, well, how is this going to go down? Is it going to be perceived that there's going to be a massive influx of money into the women's game? And so the women's game will embrace money wherever it comes from. Totally misunderstanding the politics of most of the people within the women's game, although obviously don't want to homogenize the women's game any more than the men, but to see what size of backlash there was, and then it was thought to be inappropriate. So kind of absolute contempt, floating an idea, it didn't go down very well, not now happening. And so I think this positioning of the media companies as the baddies, even worse than the Saudis, is kind of quite an interesting chain of logic.
Yeah, I think, I think that's what I think is so important is that, you know, that's why I don't want it to be this false equivalence that it's, you know, this country is just as bad as this one, because that's not the situation. I think that you have to look at each, you know, host or potential host or sponsor in their own, you know, kind of in their own terms. I do think that there has to be at some point, you know, I'm thinking about like with FIFA 2.0 and this, you know, great idea that they have of they're going to be the kind of soft power, you know, of the world. And what is our bar? Like, what is our bar for countries that can sponsor or host? So I think to Brenda's point, I mean, Qatar was an absolute, should just have never been a host for a whole host of reasons. You know, their absolute misogyny and homophobia being one of many, the treatment of migrants and whatnot. But also, you know, are we going to say, do you have to have equity of some form or shape of your women's team? Like, Saudi Arabia cannot just go and sponsor other tournaments and then have nothing invested. So I don't know, like, what is that? It's such a, we're asking for such a low bar from FIFA, I feel like, that I do think that there's just some countries and some potential, you know, sponsors that, can we agree, like, can we agree that there are just some things that are just anathema to even just the sport as bad as it is, right? And that's where I feel like what I wish would have happened with that Saudi in that moment with the rejection of the Saudi sponsorship is, yes, like, you can reject Saudi Arabia in its own right. And then I wished that we would have taken stock of the things that need to be fixed in Aotearoa and Australia. I think that's what bothered me about it is, and again, not saying like it's better or worse than Qatar, or it's going to be better or worse than CAN US, you know, New Mexico. But all right, we rejected that. And then it was like, because Australia and Aotearoa are so great. They're women. They're so progressive. Like, they have a prime minister who's a woman, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's like, no. There's still problems here. And let's take stock of those. And so I think that, again, I feel like we're sophisticated enough and we're smart enough as a species that we can do that and not fall into this kind of, like, it's a relief that Australia is hosting it because they're a progressive nation. They have women's rights and they, you know, same-sex marriage is allowable. And so I think that that's the kind of thing that I wish I would have seen some follow-up from that. All right, like, at the local level, what do we have to take stock of in order to that, to the point of, once FIFA's gone, is there even the possibility to grow this game for some of the most vulnerable people in society, in those societies that the tournament will have left?
And I think a corollary to that, Hillary, is to think about, you know, if women's football is always making progress, and the narrative is women's football is always making progress, and men's football is always too much. Yeah, it's too excessive. So women's football is making progress towards what? And then men's football does too much of this, that, and the other. And I think what is interesting is Philippe Auclair's recently done a big exposure on the sports betting industry as it pertains to men's football, and how the gambling industry has really got its kind of, you know, clutches into men's football, which for many years in the UK, betting, on-site betting on men's football was banned. So it's created a whole new sort of industry, and yet we don't have that exploitation of women's football by the sports betting industry yet. But is that what people want? Is that the progress that they're looking for? So this is why I think it's really important to look at moments of continuity and change. And the huge continuity is those systems of interrelated governance that Brenda's highlighted. And also the kind of the sort of thing that you're highlighting, which is the othering of other nations. You know, we're okay because they're doing that, and there's not this kind of moment of introspection in terms of what that means for the hosting nations.
Peter, you're muted.
Stefan's audio is not working, so he asked two questions. I'd like to maybe start with the second one, and perhaps later we'll return to the first one, since we did cover a little bit of that first question earlier in our preliminary discussion. So in the second question, he wants to come back to Angel City, I think, and the points raised by Jean. And he says, about female entrepreneurs, we saw Michelle Kang this week by Olympique Lyonnais, employing a business model comparable to the model adopted by some mega rich owners in the men's game. More generally, will concentrated ownership by the wealthy become the model for the women's game as it has for the men's? And then after that, we'll go to Pete Watson. Anyone want to chime in? And again, it's not just the panelists. Anyone else can chime in here.
I can chime in on the Latin American, you know, on Mexican, Colombian, Brazilian women's league. Those are the only real professional leagues, kind of, in Latin America, which is, I think what we're seeing here is like a limit to the politics of representation, right? Which is, while diversity and inclusion is obviously really important, and I in no way want to put myself in the camp with those that would mock its importance, there is a limit to what even a very progressive woman can do within a system that is set up and attached to MLS, like NWSL, for example, is, right? Or like the Liga Mexicana Femenil. Whereas I'm just throwing out an alternative, and you all are very knowledgeable, and you can, here's where I'm optimistic. Is that, you see, if there is member-owned clubs, and I'm just gonna go with Colo-Colo Chile for a second, right? They actually have a gender commission That gender commission has passed a new bylaw because most of the members have become dormant, you know, professional spectators and not active members of their club. They have passed a rule that the executive directorship of the club cannot be a majority of any one gender. And the men were so confused that had run the club that they just like passed this. They were like, that sounds good. Yeah, whatever, whatever that means. And what that has meant is that they've had 2 years to implement this to mentor young women leaders and non-binary leaders into these positions of power before they even knew they were being progressive. So I would say that member-owned clubs, even when professionals, offer, to my mind, the only real challenge in Latin America to the super wealthy eventual ownership on the individual level.
Would anyone like to add to Brenda's comments, perhaps with examples from North America or Europe, for instance, or elsewhere in the world? Andrew Lee says, who also is having audio problems, says, I would push back a little on Brenda's optimism.
He frequently does. No, totally taken. I'm just trying to be positive for a minute. It's true. They're equally as corrupt. Flamengos roll bad, you know, as they operate within the global landscape. But when I think to myself, how are you going to truly shake the foundations of this? It's very hard when I think about the ownership models in EPL compared to even, and I know you're going to laugh at this too, some of the Bundesliga clubs as well. So I'm just trying to think of where you insert yourself if you are not satisfied with the model that's out there mimicking the men's, and you want to kind of, no, you're right. I knew he was going to say this. We had this discussion like 2 weeks ago, and he is not wrong that people will pull out Barcelona and Real, which I specifically avoided doing because they're totally the worst examples of what I'm saying. I'm just reading the chat. But I think if I look at all, where could you push as a real feminist, as a real, you know, Marxist personally, right? Where are you going to push back? It's going to be at the member-owned level, if anywhere, and maybe you can't there either.
Okay, maybe we can return to the World Cup through Pete Watson's question, which, Pete, if it's okay, if you could ask it live.
Yep, sure. No, I was really interested with the discussions of mentioning of the absences and why they're important to be aware of who's absent. I think there's another dimension to the absences as well. And that is, for example, the countries that are very much present in this World Cup that were absent in the Qatar World Cup. I think we all know how much, you know, the Men's World Cup serves as a kind of a moment for exceptional moments of nationalism and for, you know, presidents and so on to start, you know, discussing narrative of nation around the Men's World Cup. It's obviously been the case in Colombia a great deal, as I know Brenda will be very aware. And actually, one of the things that was very interesting with Colombia's failure to qualify last year was that there was a big void, particularly in a presidential year. And the women's team in Colombia eventually took three tournaments, more or less, to do it. The Copa America, the under-20 tournament, and then the under-17 World Cup, at least managed to get kind of national attention on a much greater level for the women than they ever had do before. And I think this with this World Cup, with, I think, you know, at least Norway, I think Philippines, Vietnam, Haiti, China, Jamaica, all countries that weren't there in Qatar. I wonder if there's been much evidence of you know, politicians or narratives around those nations' presence and what kind of narratives are being said around those particular nations' presence. I'm thinking a little bit, for example, of how, you know, Thailand's women's cricket team. I mean, I don't know how many cricket experts we've got here, but, you know, there was a lot of stories about how Thailand had broken with typical traditions. You know, the kind of typical cricketing landscape to appear in that Women's World Cup, and what kind of narrative suddenly appeared for a nation that didn't really appear in many ways. So it's kind of a bit of an open question for anyone who happens to know what kind of narrative is going on, or what kind of ways the participation of those particular nations are being talked about in this particular World Cup in comparison, maybe to the men's. So just a thought, really.
Well, I can tell you, being in Italy, one of the nations that was absent in Qatar, there is no coverage and virtually no interest at all in the women's national team. So that's very anecdotal, but that's the situation here. Quite pathetic, frankly.
To give you, I mean, to give people an idea of Colombia, Linda Caicedo, who's a kind of under 18 Afro-Colombian woman, which again is not particularly common in Colombia, which often it was a slightly more middle class, slightly white Colombian that were tended to play. A newspaper, a magazine like Semana, which is a current affairs magazine, has had, you know, pretty much daily coverage of whatever she's doing in Real Madrid, which is kind of a tension that's only really being considered to James Rodriguez. So that's the kind of an idea of the kind of what that absence or that vacuum in national team, men's team reporting has kind of indirectly led to with, you know, the chance for someone to become represented in that kind of way. So that's just an example from Colombia, which, you know, just as a maybe a way of furthering discussion or at least giving an example.
Yeah, I was just going to mention for one of the host countries, which to me is really shocking, is, you know, you got a host country, so Aotearoa is one of the host countries, and it's just their coverage. It's starting to pick up now. You're starting to get a little bit more, but it was shocking how poor the coverage has been up to this point. And it's a host nation. And you compare that to the amount of coverage when, prior to the last World Cup, when the All Whites, which is the men's squad for Aotearoa, was playing Peru, and it was one of those intercontinental, you know, playoff matches, and the amount of coverage of that. And so it's like, is this another case of where it only becomes especially for these I'm going to say maybe emerging football nations, you know, nations where football has not been their primary identity sport. Is it only when the men are ascendant that then it starts to get the attention? So I've been really struck by how late the Aotearoa press has been to this. When you're a host nation, you're going to make lots of money just from tourism dollars. I would say Australia has been a lot better, and Australia has just historically done so much better than the men. The women's team has done better than the men. But I think we've seen that in the United States, though, too. We still hear even some of the commentators say, you know, especially with Qatar, like, since our men were back there, that was somehow like we were becoming a soccer nation. I was like, wait a minute. I saw some stars on someone else's jersey. So I think that's, you know, it's a common issue.
Yeah, I think there are two things happening in Europe, Pete, from my observation. One is that definitely, I think the profile that the Lionesses had last year was to some extent a rehabilitation of England football fans, a reinterpretation, consciously so, of England football fans after the absolute scenes at Wembley for the men's Euros, when, you know, that was a real moment of national shame, the way that the male England fans behaved, especially in the wider context of the killing of Sarah Everard, a young woman who was, to all extents and purposes, a young woman who was trying to buy a pizza and get home, and was murdered by a serving police officer of the Metropolitan Police Force, who stopped her under COVID rules and then raped and murdered her. I mean, the scenes around the policing of the Sarah Everard vigil were more heavy-handed than anything we saw for the policing of the men's Euros and the way in which people behave, booing, you know, the national anthems and all of that. So I think definitely in the British press, the way in which the Lionesses were, forgive me, lionized, was a way of rehabilitating England football and Wembley Stadium, particularly its national stadium, visually. And I think basically, to some extent, FIFA just didn't think it through. I mean, they've not sold the media rights in a lot of the European nations, although I understand the French case is imminent. And I understand that both the BBC and ITV are equivocating over the amount of money that's being asked to show the rights. And there is no coverage at the moment. I know England women's plans, and I'm shocked by how little coverage there's been. And again, anecdotally, talking to a lot of the Football Writers Association, a lot of newspapers are not sending people over to either New Zealand or Australia, because the matches are going to kick off at 3:30, and with people's social media, we're going to find out the results on socials rather than things being on the news. So it's going to mess with the way in which media packages have traditionally been sold. And that's why I think we're seeing this kind of dearth of coverage, because I think people don't know how to frame it as a media spectacle, not least around the scheduling of matches. So I think that contributes in large part. But also I think a lot of people are very nearsighted. We're, 38 days out, are we? And a lot of people are not... and not covering things yet.
That is true. We are more than a month away.
But Jean, if I could just maybe question the issue of timing. I mean, South Korea, Japan, right? That men's World Cup was in the middle of the night, and there was no. Right, so there is still, I mean, and I know we agree on this, right? There's still the element of the fact that it's the Women's World Cup. And sorry for the noise in the background. Someone's making lunch. They certainly do know how to do media for something that's so delayed or going to be played in the middle of the night. It's just that they don't want to or they don't feel like it's financially viable because it's the Women's World Cup, right?
Yeah, totally. I couldn't agree more, Josh. I mean, if I were, and again, with the cost of living crisis currently in the UK, we have something like 18 hospitality venues closing a week in the UK. If I owned a pub or if I owned a chain of pubs or whatever, I would be having 3:30 watching parties, you know, and I would be making it a fan festival and getting people down there. But they don't want to do it because they consider that there's no audience for it. And again, because I think women's football is considered to be a family market, you know, rather than groups of men getting together for men's World Cup, I think that's definitely feeding into it. And I think they just don't know how to frame it because it won't be news by the time that it makes the news. So and unless you have those watch parties and unless you get a kind of festival atmosphere, then how are people actually going to consume it? I guess there's going to be an awful lot of people who are watching it on their phones or their tablets or their devices. And isn't that the way that we all found one another in the women's football community is online all those years ago in 1999 or whatever when we all found one another. So it kind of speaks to that continued exclusion of the media and the assumptions behind that, which is why I think it's so interesting that you've got the likes of Alex Morgan having her own production company, you know, and a lot, I know Megan Rapinoe does as well. And I think the sports media landscape will start to change as more women take ownership for the means of production as well as the stories. I think streaming and the like will change.
Perhaps this is a good moment to go to Daniel Richter, who wanted to dig a little deeper in the broadcasting rights issues. And before I turn it over to you, Daniel, there was a comment by Lindsay who had to leave, but wanted to note that there is finally a TV broadcast deal in place in France. But she also adds, after the high-level kerfuffle earlier this year, the tournament hasn't been much in the spotlight. All right, over to Daniel.
Find some help with my connection. I also saw that looks like the BBC finally this morning seems to have secured the deal. But I'd love to ask all the panelists what they think this tells us about, you know, all of the larger issues of both greed and gender bias from FIFA, and, you know, how it got to this point, and I read an interesting article, I think it was in The Guardian, talking about, you know, just how horrible, you know, the budget is for, you know, different types of journalists in, like, freelancers at media organizations in the UK and elsewhere. And that, you know, FIFA's greed just really manages to complicate so many people's lives that work in football and want to do, you know, good journalism and are excited about the event. So look forward to hearing what panelists have to add and everyone else. Thank you.
I mean, I think the first thing is just a call back to Jean's point that Infantino claiming that this is a slap in women's face is just a kind of irony. I mean, or what, I don't know what to call it. It's just such a gross mockery of, like, our intelligence and integrity. Like, he's very happy to slap women metaphorically in the face. I mean, that's just ridiculous for him to try to present himself or use this issue to position himself as being kind of the savior of women's football. So I just want to call back Jean's first point and say, you know, 100%, but also that one of the successful broadcasting deals that they've done in Colombia and Argentina is actually the ministers of gender equity negotiating for public open access as well as private. So there's, so like in Argentina, you're going to get Canal 7 as well as private. And then also in Colombia, and Pete, you might know more about this deal with RCN on the one hand. And so there's been a mix where they've tried to step in the ministries of gender equity. And I think if you look at a national level at, you know, combating some of these systems, those ministries have been really important in intervening in women's football between the federations and, you know, media outlets, stadium venues, and FIFA, and trying to kind of put themselves there in certain cases.
Yeah, I have to say that I think the part about the audience issue, I mean, I think this is just an old adage, you know, for anyone in feminist approaches to sport, is that, yeah, if you don't show it, then there's no audience. I mean, there is an audience, and you're just, you know, so I think that that's just one of those problematic, you know, reoccurring arguments about who your audience is and who to make it available to you to make money. But also the concern that's come up about what time the matches are being shown just because of the location. You know, the Sydney Olympics were incredibly, you know, viewed successfully around the world. There was no concern about that when Brisbane has the next, you know, upcoming Olympics in 2032. You know, so we're not concerned when it comes to the Olympics in terms of there being viewership with the kind of the down under time zone. So I have a real issue with the idea that it's a combination of the gender prejudice, I think, that just still sits on top of then geographical prejudice, but not looking at historical viewing records for some of the matches and events and tournaments. I mean, Australia has held so many more tournaments. They punch well above their weight in terms of the number of tournaments that they host. And there's, you know, plentiful viewership. So I just think that that's, you know, a problematic, you know, almost like kind of straw man that people use to not really delve into the fact that the money is there. They could support the broadcasting themselves, and there is an audience. You just have to make sure that there's an audience available to, you know, that can access it.
Chris Henderson has a comment in the chat. Says, before we hit full time, wanted to let folks know that I'm organizing a panel at the NAS conference, that's the Sports Sociologists in North America conference, in November on this World Cup, and welcome any and all submissions. Call will be out shortly, but feel free to get in touch at any time. So you can get in touch with Chris Henderson in the chat as well. Other comments, questions? There's quite a few folks who haven't had a chance to ask a question or speak yet. If anyone would like to do so, feel free. We have about 14 minutes or so left in the session, plus any added time. Yes, I was just thinking of predictions and who are we really looking forward to seeing on the field. Maybe that is a good way to kind of leave on a slightly more invigorating, uplifting note. Anyone? You know, that disqualifies Andrew. That disqualifies talking about the Spanish coach.
I can say with along with Pete, Linda Caicedo is going to be fantastic. She's currently on vacation in Mexico and thus wasn't called up for the original, which kind of frustrates me because I would have liked to see her start earlier with the Colombian team. I don't know your feelings about that, Pete, but I see the U.S. women's team pretty going hard, and then I see the convocatoria, the call-ups lagging in South America. Worrisome, but I will be super excited to see her. She is phenomenal.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'd echo that. It's an incredible story. She actually debuted when she was 14, and in her first game, she came on against Cortuloa for America de Cali and beat three defenders, left them trailing in her wake, completely, you know, kind of pace and skill. She's both footed. It's really interesting the way that they talk about her. It's very interesting the fact that she has very quickly acquired a space of recognition. I think that that Brenda was talking about the kind of leverage or the influence of certain ministries in Colombia. I think that it really helps that not only Petro, who's a kind of left-wing progressive president, but also Francia Marquez, who was the vice president as an Afro-Colombian. And also at the time, there was a sports minister who's since been sacked, who was the previous Maria Isabel Urrutia, who was a weightlifter who won the gold medal in the Sydney Olympics. So there was a lot of impact from politics, but also the media, and they had an icon to suddenly get behind as well. She came 74th in the Guardian top women's footballers of the world. She's only 18. She signed for Real Madrid. She's driving a BMW that got a story as well. There have already been, yeah, I mean, she's very, very fast. She's very, very skillful. She played in three different national team tournaments for the under-20s, under-17s. And then the full team in the Copa America. So I think she's incredibly exciting. So yeah, she's going to create headlines everywhere. I think the thing that's really interesting about Colombia as well, as a kind of final point there, is the fact that you have two very traditionally figures on the margins of Colombia that become the new heroes. You have obviously Linda Caicedo for being, you know, Afro-Colombian from being. Obviously very young women, you know, all these kind of things. But you also have Luis Diaz, who is a Wayuu Indian from Guajira as well, one of the kind of marginalized departments of Colombia. So I think it's very interesting those kind of narratives are going on. So, I mean, that's what I'm kind of sitting, scribbling frantically, lots of things about at the moment. But yeah.
Yeah, and Linda had cancer, right?
Yeah.
At 15?
Yep.
Of ovarian cancer. So her story and her mother is compelling.
And also has a girlfriend. This is another thing that's now appeared in the
in Mexico, Samana.
Yeah. Samana have dealt with it in a very mature way, you know, amazingly. So yeah, big improvement for Samana magazine at the moment.
Any other players to watch?
Well, I was gonna say my students at the end of the semester, they definitely picked Colombia. That's who they, it's, we're going to see them twice. And so I think that was part of it. But I think especially after the group that had Colombia for their presentation, the class kind of fell in love with Colombia. So I think that'll be there. That's who I think my students will be rooting for sure. I hate to be that person who says, I just think it's going to be the US. And I hate to say that because that's not who I want, but all the hype around the Matildas I think is great and wonderful. I love to see like a home, you know, host nation have that kind of hype, I mean, it is a little upsetting. Like, why did Disney do the Matildas, but they didn't do the Ferns? You know, there's that kind of back to the original point about these co-hosted tournaments. It's definitely leaning heavily towards Australia and kind of unfairly to Aotearoa. But I'd like to be able to say I would love to see another team become ascendant, but I don't know. I just have that sinking feeling that it's going to be the U.S. and it doesn't help with that jingoistic ad that just came out about like the U.S. Oh, against the world.
Yes. And,
so I know I'm sorry. I know we're supposed to be optimistic. Sorry, Peter. I ended up a little pessimistically. So I have to hear what Jean has to say.
I still want to see Alex Morgan in one more. I think it's okay. I think it's okay to love some of the U.S. players. They themselves have very ambivalent relationships with patriotic jingoism.
Yeah, and I think Gwendolyn Oxenham's recent work, you know, Pride of a Nation, I was recently speaking to her about that book in relation to the work that I've recently done with the England women's team. And Gwen had got this line, which I don't think she will mind me sharing with you, is that, you know, sort of Megan Rapinoe's story is obviously her twin and then her stance against Trump, which we were all kind of celebrating, and then Brian being in prison and so on and so forth. Whereas the kind of more recent generation breaking into the US women's national team have had a lot of private coaching and they've kept their noses clean, and all they want to do is use football as a platform for their kind of post-playing career. So I think there is a lot to celebrate in terms of the current US women's national team. And Megan Rapinoe, yeah, you know, in pink hair, kind of standing up to a president while winning a World Cup, what is not to love? I'm feeling a little bit valedictory about this World Cup, I have to say, because I just am doing some work on the youth tournaments, the under 17s and 19s and 20s, which I feel like I should have done years ago, and I'm only just doing now. And I'm thinking, you know, Christine Sinclair, I'm looking at her in the 2002 under 19s Women's World Cup, and she's the top scorer in 2002, when we're going to hopefully get to watch her in 2023 in a Women's World Cup. So I'm feeling a little bit valedictory about some of those great players. It's got to be Marta's last World Cup. It's got to be Wendy Raynard's last World Cup. It's got to be, you know, there is all of that kind of sadness. So it feels like for a lot of those players, it's an end of an era, and they didn't quite get to ride the kind of gravy train that that I think will follow from this World Cup forward. They didn't quite get the profile that they're going to have, as well as the newcomers that are going to come through, the kind of Bunny Shaws and those sort of players that we're all excited to see. So I feel like it's a little bit bittersweet, this one. I don't think England are going to win, by the way.
Is that because of the injuries to Beth Mead and
Kirby? Because of the injuries, but thank in Serena we trust. I love Serena. So yeah, at least we've got a cool coach who's not abusive. Win.
okay, anyone else? Players you're going to watch for, predictions. England apparently is not going to win, says Jean. Some of us have them among the favorites for sure. The U.S. has quite a few injuries too, and it's the end of the club season, so quite a few players are nursing a variety of injuries. Daniel says Spain. That's his prediction. Chris Henderson says Sophia Smith, Golden Boot. That's one of my daughter's pick too. I really am going to miss Macario. She makes me want to watch football. There's not that many players left like that. Anyone else? I don't know if there's a way to do polls on Zoom. Those seem to be quite popular these days.
Can I ask a question for people who are keeping up on like everything? Is Ada back for Norway?
Should be.
Ada Hegerberg, is she back? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm excited to see her. That's then yes.
Oh, we missed her last time around. Big time. And so did Norway, frankly.
She was in Women's Euros, Brenda.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But she couldn't lift the team in Women's Euros. She was exceptional, but the person who really lifted her team in Women's Euros was Alexandra Popp.
Yeah.
I was in the cheap £15 seats, and her confidence, you know, is not a person that I would want to play against. When we heard she was injured ahead of the final, it was like, if we do not win this now, we are never winning it. So if she's on foot, and of course the Germans have got some fantastic players.
Yeah.
I know I'll be looking for Thembi Kgatlana of South Africa to work some of her magic. She's just recovering from an ACL. So she has, I think, just played a few minutes for Racing Louisville, a club that has come out of a very difficult period for reasons mm-hmm. many of you folks know. Thembi Kgatlana is my star from South Africa, who I'm really looking forward to seeing play. Anyone else?
I was going to say for the host countries, I guess Mary Fowler is just such an exciting young player for the Matildas. She's such a, you know, I remember just a few years ago when she was making her debut, I was like, that is one to watch. I mean, I think she's going to be great. And Grace Jolly for the Ferns. Sadly, the Ferns, I mean, it would be great to see them go far. I think you'll get to see her for three matches. But I think, you know, Ava Collins is another one. There are some young, in the host countries, there's some really exciting young talent. And I think that, you know, to that point much earlier about like the growth of the game or where it might go, I would hope that the local, you know, fans will see that there's, you know, there's just some really some young talent. And hopefully we won't get another hat trick of own goals out of Michaela Moore. That's what I'm hoping for the Ferns.
Pete Watson says Germany to win on penalties, spoken like a true Englishman.
Or like any World Cup. You worry about any tournament, that's like a 50-50 prediction, right?
Anyone else before we end this wonderful session? No one's a betting person here, huh? You're not big on FanDuel and all that stuff. Gosh, it's hard to hide from those folks now. All right, well, if there aren't any more predictions or players to watch to share, I wanted to thank our wonderful panelists, Jean and Brenda and Hillary. Really did a terrific job framing the discussion and also bringing up so many key issues that we'll all be watching and looking out for and following during this tournament. Hopefully we'll all get to watch it again, depending on where you are in the world, that might be easier or more challenging. And thank you all for attending. This also brings to a close the 2022-23 Football Scholars Forum season. We've been going for 13 years, which is truly astonishing. We've all grown older and wiser in the process. So hopefully we'll have a great season next year. If you have books that you'd like to suggest to read, to share, please let me know. The only requirement is that they don't cost $110 because we want them to be accessible. Recently, we've done some eBooks, which do bring the cost down. But other than that, enjoy the World Cup. Hillary, you'll be there with your students. So hopefully there won't be too much hooliganism going on among the young ones. And everyone have a great summer or winter if you're in the Southern Hemisphere. And take care. And it's great to see everyone. And we'll talk again soon. Peace, everyone.
Bye. Thank you.